But Thamus replied, "O most skilled Thuth, one man has the ability to father the arts, but another has the ability to judge what measure of harm or benefit they hold for those who will use them. And now you, as father of writing, have out of good will said the very opposite of what it can actually do. For this invention will produce forgetfulness in the souls of those who learn it, through neglect of memory, since, trusting in writing, they will call things to mind no longer from within themselves, but by means of external marks. What you have discovered is a remedy not for memory, but for reminding. And as for wisdom, you are giving your students the appearance of it, not the reality. For by taking in a great deal of information without proper teaching, they will appear to know a great deal when for the most part they know nothing, and they will be difficult to be around, since they have become men who seem wise instead of being wise."
"Socrates, you make up Egyptian tales, or tales from wherever you please, with the greatest of ease."
"But they say, my friend, that at the shrine of Zeus at Dodona the first prophetic words came from an oak tree. The people of that time, not being wise like you young people today, were content in their simplicity to listen to an oak, or even a rock, so long as it spoke the truth. For you, apparently, it matters who is speaking and where he's from. You don't just consider whether what's said is so or not."
"You're right to correct me, and it seems to me the matter of writing does stand, just as the man from Thebes says."
"So then, anyone who supposes he is leaving behind an art by writing it down, and anyone else who accepts it as though it will yield something clear and certain out of what has been written, must be full of a great deal of simple-mindedness, and truly ignorant of the prophecy of Ammon, if he imagines that written words amount to more than a reminder, for one who already knows, of the matters the writing is about."
"Perfectly true."
"For writing, Phaedrus has this strange feature, which makes it truly like painting. The offspring of painting stand there as if alive, but if you question them, they maintain a most solemn silence. The same is true of written words. You might think they were speaking as if they had some understanding, but if you ask them anything about what they're saying, wanting to learn more, they just go on signifying that same single thing forever. And once a thing has been written, the composition is tossed about everywhere, reaching those who understand it as well as those for whom it's not at all suited, and it doesn't know how to address the right people and not others. And when it's mishandled or unfairly abused, it always needs its father to come to its defense, for it's incapable of guarding or helping itself."
"That, too, is quite rightly said."
"Well, then, do we see another kind of speech, a legitimate brother of this one, and notice by what process it comes about, and how much better and more capable it is by birth?"
"What kind of speech do you mean, and how does it come about?"
"The kind that is written together with knowledge in the soul of the learner, one capable of defending itself, and knowing to whom it should speak and before whom it should keep silent."
"You mean the living, breathing speech of the man who knows, of which the written kind might fairly be called an image."
"Exactly so. Now tell me this. Would a sensible farmer, who cared about certain seeds and wanted them to bear fruit, plant them in earnest in some garden of Adonis in the heat of summer, and take delight in watching them spring up beautiful in 8 days? Or would he do that, if he did it at all, only as play and for the sake of a festival? While for the seeds he was serious about, he would use the proper art of farming, sow them in suitable ground, and be content to see, in the 8th month, what he had sown come to completion."
"That's how he would do it, Socrates, I should think, seriously in one case, in some other way, as you say, in the other."
"And shall we say that the man who has knowledge of what is just and fine and good has less sense than the farmer, when it comes to his own seeds?"
"Certainly not."
"Then he won't, in all seriousness, write them in ink, sewing them through a pen together with words that are unable to defend themselves by argument and unable to teach the truth adequately."
No, that's not likely at all.
No, indeed. Rather, it seems he will sow and write his gardens of letters when he does write them, for the sake of play, storing up reminders for himself, against the old age of forgetfulness, should it come to that, and for anyone else following the same track, and he will take pleasure in watching them grow up tender. And when others turn to other kinds of play, watering themselves with drinking parties and all else akin to that, he, it seems, will instead pass his time in play of the sort I'm describing.
A splendid kind of play, indeed, you're describing, Socrates, next to a poor one. The play of a man able to amuse himself with words, spinning tales about justice and the other things you mention.
That's exactly how it is, my dear Phaedrus. But I think a far finer seriousness attends these matters, when someone, using the art of dialectic, takes a soul suited to it and plants and sows within it words joined with knowledge. Words able to defend both themselves and the one who planted them, not barren but bearing seed, from which others grow in turn in other characters, sufficient to keep this seed forever immortal, and to make the one who has it as happy as it is possible for a human being to be.
What you describe now is finer still.
And now, Phaedrus, since we've agreed on these things, we can finally judge the matter we set out to examine.
Which matter?
The one we came here wanting to look into in the first place, so that we might examine the reproach leveled at Lysias concerning the writing of speeches, and consider speeches themselves, both those composed with skill and those without it. Now, what belongs to art and what doesn't seems to me to have been shown well enough?
So it seemed to me too, but remind me again how.
Not until someone knows the truth about each thing he speaks or writes about, and is able to define the whole of it in itself, and having defined it, knows how to cut it up again according to its natural kinds down to what can no longer be divided, and in the same way, having seen through the nature of the soul, discovers the form of speech suited to each nature, and so arranges and orders his speech, giving complex speeches to a complex soul and simple ones to a simple soul. Not until then will it be possible for the whole class of speeches to be handled skillfully, so far as its nature allows, whether for teaching or for persuading, as our whole discussion up to now has shown.
Yes, that's exactly how it appeared to us.
And what about the question whether it's a fine or a shameful thing to speak and write speeches, and under what conditions this practice would rightly be called a reproach, or not? Hasn't what we said a little earlier made that clear?
Made what clear?
That whether Lysias or anyone else ever has written or ever will write, privately or in a public capacity, laying down laws in the form of a political treatise, and believing there is great reliability and clarity in it, that in itself is a reproach to the writer, whoever says so or not. For to be ignorant of what is just and unjust, good and bad, whether awake or dreaming, cannot in truth escape being blameworthy, even if the whole crowd applauds it.
No, indeed it can't.
But the man who thinks that in a written speech on any subject there must be much that is playful, and that no speech, whether in verse or prose, has ever been worth serious attention, who thinks, too, that the speeches recited in public without cross-examination or teaching are meant only to persuade, and were never really composed to convey knowledge to those who already know the best of what is said, but who reserves his real seriousness for the case where teaching and learning are truly the aim, and words are truly written in the soul concerning what is just and beautiful and good, such words alone he considers to have clarity and completeness, and to be worth taking seriously, since they are, so to speak, his own legitimate children. First the one born within himself, if it has been found there, and then any offspring and siblings of that one that have grown, as they deserve, in other souls besides, and who bids the rest of his writings good day, that man, Phaedrus, is likely to be the sort of person that you and I might pray to become.
That is exactly what I want, and pray for.
Well then, we have had our fill of playing with speeches for now. Go and tell Lysias that you and I went down to the spring and shrine of the nymphs and heard words there, words that instructed us to say to Lysias, and to anyone else who composes speeches, and to Homer, and to anyone else who has composed poetry, whether spoken or sung, and third to Solon, and whoever else has written political compositions calling them laws. If such a person composed his work knowing where the truth lies, and is able to come to its defense when questioned about what he has written, and can himself show by argument that his writings are of little worth, then he should not be called by a name taken from these writings, but rather by the name of what he has taken seriously.
Then what names do you give him?
To call him wise, Phaedrus, seems to me too grand a thing, fitting for a god alone. But to call him a lover of wisdom or something of that sort would suit him better and be more fitting.
And that's not at all off the mark.
And on the other hand, the man who has nothing more valuable than what he has composed or written, turning it over this way and that over time, gluing bits together and taking others apart him, you would rightly call a poet, or a speechwriter, or a lawmaker.
Of course.
Tell this, then, to your friend.
And what about you? What will you do? We mustn't leave out your own friend either.
Which friend do you mean?
The handsome Isocrates. What will you announce to him, Socrates? What shall we say he is?
Isocrates is still young, Phaedrus, but I am willing to say what I foresee for him.
What is that?
It seems to me that he has a nature superior to that of Lysias's kind of speeches, and that it is mixed, besides, with a nobler character. So it would be no surprise, as he grows older, if in the very kind of speeches he now attempts he should surpass, by as much as a grown man surpasses children, all who have ever put their hand to speech-making, and if that does not satisfy him, that some more divine impulse should carry him on to greater things. For by nature, my friend, there is a certain love of wisdom present in that man's mind. This, then, is the message I send from these gods here, to Isocrates as my favorite, and you may send yours, in turn, to Lysias as your own.
It will be done, but let us go, since the heat has grown gentler now.
Shouldn't we pray before setting out?
Of course.
Dear Pan and all you other gods here present, grant that I become beautiful within, and as for what is outside me, may it be friendly to what is within. May I consider the wise man rich, and may I have as much gold as no one but a man of sound mind could bear to carry or spend. Do we need anything else, Phaedrus? For my part, I have prayed enough.
Pray the same for me too. Friends hold all things in common.
Let us go.